All right, you're listening to Radio Naturopath here at WHUS 91.7 FM. I am here with my co-host, Ron.
Good morning, Fran.
Yeah, so it's a lovely morning here. It's a little chilly.
It's still nice out, though.
It's
the sun's out, and there's flowers coming up, and it's just, you can see the bugs in the air. Ooh, it's spring.
It's okay.
And the skunk cabbage is coming out.
Skunk cabbage is starting to come up, yes.
And I'll bet there's some significance to skunk cabbage, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's probably a very useful thing.
Simplocarpus.
There you go.
It's fun to say.
I knew I could bring something out of Fran.
I love saying Simplocarpus, don't you?
Oh, yeah, that's good.
So Simplocarpus is the genus of skunk cabbage.
Okay.
And it's very interesting because you know that spring is coming when it starts to come up and it just gleefully starts poking its head out of all of the wetlands. And there is some doctrine of signatures about the skunk cabbage. I don't know why they call it skunk cabbage. I think maybe when you pull it apart, it stinks. It's not like when you get near it, it stinks. But
and
I'm always...
Why does it stink? Why does it smell like
it
skunk?
It probably... like I said, I'm not sure if it smells.
Maybe we'll find out.
But there's probably a reason why it's called skunk cabbage. And it may be that it tastes skunkier than, you know, domestic cabbage that you eat as a vegetable. But it is a very useful plant, and you can use skunk cabbage. Skunk cabbage is one of those plants that you use as a medicinal herb, and it is a very good medicinal herb. It's it's an expectorant.
Yeah.
So if you use so it's something that's a good addition to any cough formula, and so people do take it and they tincture the leaves, meaning they extract them in alcohol, and it can be used in a nice formula as an expectorant. But it is one of the herbs that in small amounts it's an expectorant, and in large amounts it can make you throw up, unfortunately.
It's a wetland wildflower known for its putrid smell.
Okay, so it is stinky. But yeah. When I'm riding my bike past it, I don't smell it.
It's because it doesn't smell until you disrupt it.
Okay.
Until you crush the leaves or crumple them or step on them.
Okay.
That's when it happens.
So it's skunky. So like when you go, if you were going to go try to eat it or use it as a, use it into your tincture, it's gonna smell stanky. It's probably got some sulfur compounds in it. And there's another plant that is similar to skunk cabbage in the same idea that in small doses, it's an expectorant. In large doses, it makes you throw up. And that's lobelia, the Indian paintbrush.
Okay.
So very similar.
Hey, besides its putrid smell, another distinguishing feature of skunk cabbage is its ability to emit warmth.
Oh, well, that's nice.
Isn't that interesting?
That's nice. So that means if you go out for your rail trail ride, because now when we go out for the rail trail, some of the rail trail is kind of damp. I even rode through an actual puddle bordering on Vernal Pond on the airline trail north. But that's one of the places I first see a lot of the skunk cabbage, because it's, you wind up kind of having to drain the rail trail, and so that there's water, there's sort of spring water sources along the rail trail on either side. So we get to see a lot of skunk cabbage on the sides of the trail. So I'm very aware of it there. And of course, if you go in the woods, especially where there are vernal ponds,
yeah,
you're going to see the skunk cabbage. Yes,
mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So its doctrine of signatures things is it needs a lot of moisture, so it's going to suck up moisture. So it's going to help you to release your moisture too.
So in the cold and snowy places, you'll notice that skunk cabbage emerges around everything else and comes through because it emits its own heat.
Oh, that's,
so that's
nice.
Yeah, isn't that kind of neat?
So other things like to be around it because it's warm.
Right.
That's nice. Well, that's kind of a nice thing because it's one of the first things to come up in the spring. So it warms everything else up. It's like, all right, everybody, we're ready. Come on out. You can all come out to play. It's like the skunk cabbage is beckoning the spring. That's kind of a nice way to look at it. I'm always very happy to see it.
And if you want to know how old a skunk cabbage is, start digging, because the older they get, the deeper their roots go.
Oh.
Interesting.
That's very nice. Yeah. So, yeah, I've definitely have been noticing the skunk cabbage. I went on the airline trail north, starting in North Windham and going north, and it's just starting to come up, and I'm sure that by the weekend there'll be more of it. Very nice.
So that's a little bit about skunk cabbage.
Yeah.
Kinda cool.
Why did we start talking about skunk cabbage?
Because I said, because the skunk cabbage is coming up.
Okay.
Because it's something that I'm noticing
when
we're out on our bicycle rides this time of year. I'm seeing certain things that are starting to come out. The forsythia is now blossoming, and there's lots of big yellow bursts as you're riding your bike down the road. It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
And, you know, things are starting to come to life. All the little bushes on the side of the road, they're getting little green flowers, green leaves on them. The briars are coming out. The maples have their red little whatever those. I don't know if those are. I don't know if those are buds or not, but they're something. They all get the red.
And my patients are coming in doing this. Achoo, achoo, achoo.
No.
Drip, drip, drip. Snot, snot, snot. eyes. Excuse me. there, I got a real
there,
one for you.
That's some serious improv. There.
I decided to do it on the air because I was talking about asthma and allergies. So speaking of talking about asthma and allergies, if you're interested, I will be at the Mansfield Community Center tonight from 6:30 to 7:30 speaking about that very topic.
Oh, no kidding.
Wow,
local.
Local. If you're interested, you can go. And for more information, you can call the Mansfield Community Center at 860-429-3015. That's 860-429-3015.
You know that phone number off the top of your head? You didn't even reference. I have to look at everything. I can't believe
no.
you do that.
That's a phone number I kind of look at a lot, and I have to call periodically and like that. So.
All right, then.
So we have a couple of items to discuss. Why don't we talk about that thing that you wanted to talk about?
Oh, do you have that there in front of you?
I have that there in front of me.
Okay, good, because that was – I do not have that in front of me, but okay. I will pull it up here in a second.
No worries. So Bicycling Magazine came out with an article about DVT. Deep vein thrombosis, and it's something that athletes can get. I mean, it's more common in people who have other issues, but athletes can get DVTs. And endurance athletes' lifestyles may make them more susceptible to DVT. So what's a deep venous thrombosis? What it means is usually happens in the deep veins of your legs. You get a blood clot. And so it can happen to people who are very, very fit. And what you'll notice is that you might have a lot of pain all of a sudden. You'll have pain in your legs, and you'll have deep pain in your legs. And the thing is, if you're a very fit athlete, you might not realize that you're actually having this going on. You just might think that you pulled a calf muscle. And, you know, we're used to dealing with pain. I mean, I did a dumb thing. I went running last week after not running for a very long time. And I even walked on either end of it, and I did – you know, Jeff Galloway, 2 minutes on, 1 minute off, and I still pulled something.
And
so
your legs said, "What are you doing?"
Yes, they sure did. And so, and after that, you know, now I'm still sore, but I'm definitely sore. And a lot of people will go, "Up, oh, I'm not going to do any exercise till this heals." And not me. I mean, I'm back on the bike, and so this thing is going to take a little longer to heal because I insist upon continuing to ride my bike. Although I'm not going to do any impact until this thing heals. And I'm so happy I'm going to go to the chiropractor on Friday, and he'll do some nice things for me there. But anyway, so this DVT, the scary thing about a DVT, first of all, it can block circulation locally. And if it blocks it bad enough, you can get ischemia, that is reduced blood flow to the area, which is very dangerous. But what's even worse is if the blood clots break off and they travel through your body and wind up in your lungs. They wind up in your lungs. They can cause blood clots to your lungs, and they can stop you from breathing. So it's a medical emergency. And so the thing that's scary about it happening to athletes is they don't think that this is what is happening to them. I mean, if you're somebody who doesn't exercise, you're not eating right, you have medical conditions anyway, you might be looking for this sort of thing. You're like, uh-oh, I have another thing going on. I'm going to go to the doctor. But an athlete might just think they're having leg pain, and you could get leg pain just from, you know, pushing on your pedal too hard, or you leaned into your turn too much, and then you pedaled out of the corner a little too hard and in a bad angle, and you could pull something, and you might think that that's what happened. Or you might be a runner. Same thing. It's really easy to pound down on the pavement and have leg pain. So here's why. So one of the things is you can be genetically predisposed to getting DVTs. There are definitely genetic factors that make it so that you're more likely to get blood clots. You could have, I don't want to say that there's just like big genetic terms, but there's things that you can get tested for, and your doctor can test you for those. You can have protein C and protein S anomalies, which are blood clotting factors. You can have other factors. There's a number of genes that are associated with blood clotting, and if you have an extra copy of those, you're going to be more likely to get blood clots. It says here 5 to 8% of the population are born with a genetic predisposition for a blood clotting disorder. That's not a small amount. That means that you probably know somebody who has one. I certainly do. I mean, I've had a couple of patients come in who had blood clots, who had not necessarily DVT, but they had a pulmonary embolism. So let's talk about our terms. The word pulmonary means of or having to do with the lungs, and embolism means... it means something floating around in the blood that shouldn't be there. Mm-hmm. That's an embolism. It could be made of anything. It could be made of air. It could be a blood clot. So a blood clot is a thromboembolism, but an embolism is an object in the blood that shouldn't be there. You can get an air embolism. So if you have a breach of a blood vessel and air gets in, you can have air that floats through your blood, and that can happen. And air embolisms can be just as dangerous because they get to your heart and they block circulation. And once they block your heart and also your lungs, and once they block blood flow and airflow to your lungs, you can stop breathing. You cause respiratory failure. So why else? Can you get a DVT even if you don't have a predisposition? So there's a few things. If you are if you're a very accomplished athlete, you may have a low resting heart rate. So when you're especially immobile or sedentary, your calf muscles don't contract as much to help circulation, and so blood can pool there. So sitting in a cramped plane for a long time is an obvious one, but also people will get... you can get a DVT from sitting for a long time at your desk.
Yeah.
So this is another reason why, if at all possible, don't stay seated at your desk for more than half an hour to an hour at a time. You can set timers on your phone. You can set timers. Get a timer of any kind. Get an egg timer if you don't want to use your phone. But I'm fortunate in that I have a lot of control over how much I sit, because if I'm seeing patients, I'm getting up at least every half hour, if not more. And then when I'm doing my book work at the end of the day, my chart work at the end of the day, sometimes what I'll do is, you know, if I have a stack of charts, sometimes I have a stack of charts 17 to 20 deep. It's wow. Anyway, so I will actually do a chart, you know, read the labs or write the letter or whatever it is I have to do with that one chart. And then when I'm done the chart, it's not as efficient, but it's good for my body. I will take that chart, because the chart doesn't live at my desk. The chart then has to go on to somewhere else, either the back desk or the front desk. So I'll just actually walk it out and go on to the next chart. And that's a really good thing for me. And I don't have a boss standing over me saying, don't do that. I'm my boss. I'm the boss standing over me saying, you should do that. Mm. And so I pick up the chart. And I bring it to its next destination. And that forces me to get up a lot. I mean, it could make me get up 5 times in an hour, which is much better than me just sitting there. And also that getting up and down keeps me alert. So because I'm not just sitting there. And it increases blood flow to my brain. So go ahead.
So I'm looking here at compression stockings for deep vein thrombosis.
That they'll help you not to have them. Is that right?
Yeah, designed to help blood circulate in your legs. They also may help prevent deep vein thrombosis.
We used to do that. We haven't done that. Like we used to, like when we were done with our bike rides, we put on our compression stockings. And
whenever
to do that.
I fly, the same thing.
Yeah, you wear your compression
if you get
stockings
on an airplane, because you can sit on an airplane for, you know, maybe 3 or 4 hours, maybe more, and you put the socks on. I actually gave them to our friend Michael when he flew down to, where did he go? He went way down. So he went to
the Caribbean.
No. He went to climb mountains down in South America. I can't remember.
Patagonia.
Where thank you.
Yeah.
And I gave him my compression socks.
Oh, that's good.
And said, these will help.
I never thought of that. I should just bring compression socks in on the airplane. Mm-hmm. That's a great idea.
Yeah, see that?
And then your legs, if you wear them, your legs will feel really refreshed, and you can take them off as soon as you get off the plane if you want to. If not, like if you have, the thing is compression stockings while you're walking are awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, I wear them when I run. If I do run or serious walking, I wear them. I've taken to always wearing them, compression stockings and compression garments, shorts and capris when I run.
So the medical experts don't agree on the usefulness of compression stockings.
Is that right?
Yeah, but so there's a debate about this.
I'm a fan. As someone who's used them, I find them very good. So this is the problem when you if you're a big athlete, you might have a resting heart rate in the 60s, 50s, 40s. I mean, if I'm very relaxed, I can get down into the 40s.
Yeah, me too.
And, you know, however, you know, if I'm sitting at the doctor, I got measured the other day, it was 68. But that I don't consider that a true resting heart rate because I'm active. I'm talking to the doctor. I may be sitting there, but I'm still active and talking to the doctor. I'm going about my day. But when I wake up in the morning, it's going to be lower than that. The thing is, if you're an athlete or even if you're not, doesn't matter. It you should move around from time to time. It's a good idea to do. So just the slow blood flow, the slow heart rate of the trained athlete can cause pooling in the calves. And also, if you've used your calves a lot, they're hypertrophying, they're growing, so there's pressure on them. So now, if you're actually moving those calves, then it's a good thing because there's one of the things they call the calves is your second heart because it's pumping your blood upwards. It's how you get your venous blood, the blood from your veins, up from down south, from your feet and up to your and your legs on up because veins don't have a pulse. The way circulation happens throughout your body is that your arteries do have a pulse. They have muscles and they have nerves that cause them to pulse. So when you feel your radial pulse, that's when, you know, what we think of as taking our pulse. When you take your pulse in your wrist, you know, if you take the pulse that's start at your thumb, go downward along the side of your wrist and find that little bump on the side of your wrist there, that's part of the bone in your arm called the radius. And the bump there is called the radial head or the radial tuberosity. Anyway, you feel that bump, the radial tuberosity, and then you come inward towards the center of your body as your palm is facing up, and you'll feel your pulse right there. Well, that's the radial artery, and that's pulsing. And it has its own pulse. It's pulsing in tune with the heart, and there's a neurological signal that causes the muscles to contract, and you can feel your pulse. Arteries pulse. Veins do not. Veins have gates along them, and so the arteries and the muscles actually push blood up through the veins so that blood can come up back to the heart and then be sent to the lungs for purification. So the veins in your legs can be compressed because you've got these heavy calves in there. So if your calf muscle, if you're an athlete, and you're hypertrophying your calves because you're a cyclist or you're a runner or you're doing some kind of activity that's making your calf muscles grow, or if you're a weightlifter and you've got big calves, if you've just done a lot of activity, they're swollen. They're normally swollen. Your muscles that you have just used swell. That's normal. That's what they normally do. And there's a little bit more chance after your workout for them to for blood to pool, especially if you have a low resting heart rate. So it's a good idea after your activity, especially if you have a low heart rate, to move those calves around. Even if you're sitting still, it might annoy people, but you may want to do toe flexes, circle your ankles in either direction, massage your calves. Just keep things moving a little bit. Make sure you rehydrate well because that will help with the circulation as well. And you can sit and massage your calves. If you're just sitting chatting with somebody, you can sit and massage your calves. And if you're sitting with a good friend, you can massage each other's calves if you want to. And that will help to reduce the likelihood of getting a blood clot after a workout. Being adequately hydrated will help too, as I said. So the other thing that can make you more likely to have DVTs is estrogen. So however you're getting the estrogen, if you are a menopausal woman, and menopausal women, we tend to be, well, most women, unfortunately, tend to be estrogen dominant. And the estrogen dominance happens because our livers are taxed. They're taxed because we're stressed and we're trying to manage our stress hormones with our livers. And So, and we also, progesterone is the first hormone to tank when you're menopausal. So you're going to tend to be estrogen dominant. You don't have as easy ways to make progesterone as you do estrogen, even when you're in menopause. When you're in menopause, you're still going to get you're still going to get some estrogen made by your ovaries, and you're also going to make estrogen from your fat tissue. And you make more estrogen from fat tissue and ovaries than you do progesterone. Progesterone usually is going to be made. It's going to be made kind of indirectly. It's going to be produced to some extent from adrenal hormones and from androgens, but it's not favored. That women tend to be lower in progesterone when they're menopausal. Women tend to be lower in progesterone anyway. Why is that? Well, guess what? There's an easy two-step procedure to convert progesterone to cortisol. So if you are stressed out, which a lot of women are, your body's going to go, all right, we're going to use this progesterone to run you around, because obviously you're running away from danger. So we're going to take your progesterone. Progesterone is a hormone that maintains pregnancy and allows you to have a nice uterine lining for implantation. So it's necessary for pregnancy, and you make tons of it when you're pregnant. So if your body thinks that you're running away from a bear, you're running away from danger, you're running away from marauding invaders, you're going to take your progesterone, and you can turn it into cortisol, because you need that cortisol to run your fight or flight, to increase the circulation to your lungs, your heart, your skeletal muscles, to run away from the presumed danger. So you're going to tend to be estrogen dominant and progesterone insufficient. Estrogen is a good time, because estrogen has coagulative properties. It raises your clotting risk. Guess what else raises your clotting risk? Fake progesterone, that is progestins, as found in chemical contraception. So does the ethinyl estradiol that's usually found in your chemical contraception. So if you're taking birth control pills, that increases your clotting risk. It doesn't matter your age. I gave a talk once at Eastern, and I had a 19-year-old young woman raise her hand and say, my friend got a blood clot, and she's 19, and she was on birth control pills. It can happen to anyone. You're more likely to have it happen when you're older, but it can happen to anyone. Couple that with, I didn't realize I had a genetic predisposition for deep venous thrombosis. Guess what? You can get blood clots then as well. So any chemical contraception can do it. The combination pill and a progestin-only pill. Also, don't forget that there, and I have to remind women to tell me this, because I have women list the medications they're on, and they forget that non-oral contraception with drugs in it is also one of the medications they're on. So if you're on the Mirena IUD or any of the IUDs that contain levonorgestrel, the chemical ones, generally IUDs, whether they're called Mirena or there's some generic brands, there's another brand that's not Mirena that has the same drug in it. It's called levonorgestrel. It's a fake progesterone, progestin, and it goes into your uterus, and just the mechanical placing of an object in your uterus causes contraception, but so does the placing of this fake progesterone. Fake progesterone doesn't support pregnancy like real progesterone does. It blocks your progesterone receptors. Unfortunately, fake progesterones, unlike real progesterone, are more likely to give you blood clots. Real progesterone does the opposite. It's anti-inflammatory, and it tends to reduce your risk. So if you're a little more progesterone sufficient, you're going to be less likely to get blood clots. It's estrogen dominance that causes the problem. But unfortunately, with chemical contraception, you're blocking both your real estrogen and your real progesterone. And guess what? The ethinyl estradiol, even though it's an estrogen analog, it also increases your risk of blood clots. So all chemical contraception, whether it's a pill, whether it's a mini pill, which means progestin only, whether it's the Nuva ring, the ring that has ethinyl estradiol and some kind of progestin in it as well, whether it's an IUD that has a chemical hormone in it, they all increase your risk of blood clots. So if you're on one of those estrogen-containing substances or hormonal-containing substances, and you're a very fit athlete, and you have one of the genes, your risk is higher. So that's something you have to be really careful about. So one of the things to do, if you have the symptoms of DVT, you're going to have swelling. You'll have leg pain, which is similar to a cramp or a pull. Tenderness. This is what to look for: warmth and redness of the skin and skin discoloration, and it may look even reddish blue. So you're going to see changes in the color of your skin. And even worse, if you have a pulmonary embolism, meaning that the blood clot made it to your lungs, you're going to have chest pain, difficulty breathing. You might actually cough up blood and have a racing heart rate and lightheadedness. If you have any of those symptoms, you're going to get bussed to the hospital. So how the heck do you prevent it? Like I said, compression socks can be helpful. Wearing them whenever you feel like it. Just moving around. Like I said, moving around, massaging those muscles when you're sitting around chatting with your buddies afterwards. Massage each other, massage yourselves, and just do, calf circles and point your toes and flex them and circle your ankles. And all the things I said, I didn't even have to read this. I already told you. Stay hydrated. Hydrate, hydrate, hydrate. Like Evan Johnson says, hydrate or die. Reconsider your contraception, right? It says here, pop some baby aspirin. If that's all you got, I'm okay with that. But I have to tell you that there's other things that can make your blood thinner that aren't aspirin. There's loads of them. If you take fish oil regularly, if you take vitamin E regularly, if you take magnesium, if you eat a really good diet, if you eat lots of produce, if you eat fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, clean animal protein, if you eat fish, if you eat berries, all of those things are going to be really high in blood thinning substances. Most plants have anticoagulant substances in them. Yes, leafy greens have vitamin K in it, which help with clotting, but they have a lot of phytochemicals that keep your blood thinner. And fish oil is really good for you anyway if you happen to be an athlete, because it helps you rebuild your cells, it helps to reduce inflammation, and it does, in fact, thin your blood. So does vitamin E, like I said. If you have an ongoing program of taking some supplements and also eating a diet that causes your blood to be thinner, you're going to be at lower risk. I also have to point out that there are food. Anything that causes inflammation is going to put you at higher risk. So if you're eating poor quality meat, for example, it's going to be high in arachidonic acid. Arachidonic acid is pro-inflammatory. So if you're eating CAFO meat, meat that was raised on a group farm where they fed them GMO corn, the meat's going to be high in linoleic acid, and that's going to be pro-inflammatory. So eating your post-ride burger, really a good idea to get grass-fed.
Right.
Or chicken or turkey.
Stay away from that American beef.
That's
not organic and right. Grass-fed. Right.
Right. The grass-fed is not just for woo-woo ha-ha people. Mm. This is why grass-fed is better. Mark my words. When animals eat GMO corn, when animals eat corn anyway, when cattle eat corn, again, I'm going to say this for the 2,000th time. You ever see a cow grazing in a cornfield?
I was going to say, they put this big cornfield in at the end of the road. And last year, I saw a bunch of cows out there like stampeding into the cornfield so they could eat. I'm kidding.
Not. Exactly. Exactly.
They're nowhere to be seen.
That's right. So cows don't eat corn.
Right.
Right. Cows would much rather eat your grass and your weeds, and mostly grass and weeds.
Yeah.
And that's it, but not corn.
Yeah, they'll eat weeds. They love weeds.
Yes.
Chomp them right down.
That's right. And if you put your cows in a meadow and there's a biodiversity of plants in there, you're going to be more nourished if you drink their milk or if you eat their meat. Because they're going to have more biodiversity of stuff. So you don't want to have like just grass. You want to have clover, and you want to have couch grass or crabgrass, and you want to have dandelions and daisies and all kinds of cool stuff. And then you're going to be healthier, and so will they. If they eat corn, cows get sick when they eat corn because cows are ruminants. I had to explain rumination to somebody, the whole concept of rumination, because they didn't understand that the idea when you ruminate on something, it's when you think about something over and over, and it comes from ruminant animals. A ruminant animal is an animal that chews its cud. And, so cows have a four-chambered stomach, so do sheep and goats. And they eat the grass. It goes into the first chamber. Right. Then they choke it back up, and they sit there and chew their cud. Chew. Mm-hmm. And they just sort of ruminate. And they're just like standing there peacefully doing the same old
yep.
for a long time. And that's just what they do. And if they have to ruminate on corn, it's not good for them. Their bodies don't digest it well. And when they process it, they make inflammatory omega-6 fatty acids. When they eat only grass and weeds, they make omega-3 fatty acids. And then their fat ratio is much closer. So when you have cattle eating GMO corn, the fat ratio will be omega-6 to omega-3. The ratio will be like 26 to 1. And when you feed them exclusively pasture, then their fat ratio becomes omega-6 to omega-3, 4 to 1, which is the same as fish. So that's why I tell people, if you want to eat grass-fed beef, have at it. If you digest it well, have at it. I don't eat a lot of red meat because I don't digest it well. I can eat a grass-fed burger once a week if I've done a very hard bike ride. And if I haven't done a very hard bike ride, I don't do it. I have to be craving it. And if I don't crave it, it just kind of goes through me slow because my digestion's not so fast.
Mm.
But anyway, so corn-fed beef will likely increase your risk of DVT. It will make you clot more readily. The other things that make you clot, anything that you eat that causes inflammation, if you're eating a food that gives you a bad stomach, it's a good idea not to eat it because it's causing inflammation. Anything that causes inflammation is going to make your platelets stickier and they're going to stick together worse. The other thing is sugar, 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 sugar. Sugar makes your platelets stickier anyway, even if you're not pre-diabetic. The more sugar you eat, you're going to have stickier platelets. Sugar causes inflammation, even if you don't have diabetes and you don't have high blood sugar. The more sugar you eat, the more you're at more cardiovascular risk of all kinds, and including the fact that your platelets become stickier and they want to stick together more. Platelets want to stick together more, you're more likely to get a blood clot. So too much sugar is not a good thing for anyone. If you have a little bit of sugar, but you have a lot of produce and a lot of other stuff that thins your blood, you're probably going to be okay. But having a diet where you're eating a lot of sugary stuff and a lot of starchy stuff, and to the exclusion of vegetables and fruit and nuts and seeds and clean protein, you're going to be more likely to get blood clots. Yeah.
Yeah.
So sugar itself can increase your risk of blood clots. If you have diabetes, of course, you're at a higher risk of blood clots because independent of whether your red blood cells are making more hemoglobin A1C, platelets become stickier in the presence of lots of sugar and starch. So you really have to watch that. It's a really good idea. Like I said, if you are an athlete, eating high octane fuel is a really good idea. Very surprising, huh?
So, yeah, really.
So the cool thing is, I talked about all the preventions before I read the preventions in the article. I already said them. You keep moving. Stay hydrated. Hydrate, hydrate, hydrate. Reconsider your contraception, because if you're, if you're a woman, because they don't have a male pill, or if they have a male pill, it's not available to us at this time. But it does say consider switching to an IUD or progestin-only mini pill. But I don't agree with that because progestin still can raise your risk of blood clots. I say, unfortunately, if you're doing chemical contraception and you're worried about blood clots, it's a good idea to switch to something else like barrier methods or fertility awareness. If you're an athlete, fertility awareness could be a little because when you're that athletic, it pushes your hormones fluctuate a lot. So you may not be able to get a good read on whether you're fertile if you're doing fertility awareness, where you're checking your cervical mucus and you're checking the time of your month of your cycle. That might not be so adequate. So using a barrier method might be the best bet if you are a serious athlete. So there you go, DVTs. Men and women can get them, and you know, very fit people can get it. The other thing that I didn't say, but it's a risk for getting a DVT, is if you've had an injury, especially if you've had a fracture, because you lose blood. You know, you can get some escaping cells from your bone marrow if you've had a fracture. So you're at a higher risk for thromboembolism if you've had a fracture, and that's at any age.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's amazing, isn't it?
I know. It's kind of a bummer. All right. So there you go. So that's the deal with That's the deal with DBT. So that was an interesting topic. Remember, you can call us. The number to call is 860-486-9487. That's 860-486-9487. You can text us at that number as well. And you can email us at radionaturopath@gmail.com. All right. So speaking of hormones, I wanted to address belly bloat. Because that, believe it or not, that's an interesting, I don't know if it's such an interesting topic to men, but it's beyond interesting to women because it happens to us all the time. And people, some people trash women for wearing yoga pants. Let me tell you, there's a reason why.
I know why.
Okay. So why do women like to wear yoga pants now and leggings and all these pants, these pointelle pants and all these pants with stretchy stuff in them? I'm going to tell you right now, if I have narrow hips, my hip bones are very close together. Even if I'm chubby, the hip bones are still very close together. My sister, who's a big girl, when she had her babies, she actually had to have C-sections because her hips are actually quite narrow, even though she's large. So when Nancy and I gain weight, we gain forward. Nancy carried her babies out front. And when we gain weight, we get big bellies because there's nowhere else for it to go. We don't have big tuchuses. We don't tend to gain weight in our butts and our hips. Like, I'm not a real curvy girl.
You're curvy enough.
I'm curvy enough. Yeah. But I don't have that hourglass figure.
Well, no, you don't, but you,
right.
You know.
And I have a flat butt.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, so I have these hip bones that are very close together. And so if I wake up in the morning, I'm not particularly bloated. But if I eat a meal, it has nowhere to go. So it sticks out. So if I am wearing a pair of pants that fit me perfectly fine, in an hour, my belly will be pressing against them. That's why women like to wear... there's this new trend, athleisure. So it's where you can go out and wear your athletic wear just to run around and do errands. So you'll see women going out this time of year in very pretty capris that are athletic wear, and they're gorgeous. Like, they, you know, they'll be different colors and they'll be, you know, have lovely patterns on them. And I was impressed that I was at a Starbucks. I was traveling down Fairfield, down to New Jersey, and I would see women going to the Starbucks, and they were just going to Starbucks, and they had athletic wear, and I wondered if they were coming for the gym or if they were just running around. And then I had a lovely young woman come to my practice the other day, and she was wearing a beautiful pair of athletic capris. They were black with big, pretty roses on them, and I said, those are gorgeous. And then I mentioned to her this thing about how I see people going out and about in their athletic wear. And she said to me, this young millennial woman, she said to me, this is a trend and it's called athleisure, where you can go out and wear this athletic wear. And she looked at me and she said, I don't want to wear a pair of pants that presses on my belly. And I looked at her and I said, girlfriend, I feel you. I know just what you're talking about. I'm the same way. And I think that day I was wearing a pair of pointelle pants or stretchy pants as well. You know, the stretchy pants and tunics thing came in. Remember a few years back, the belly shirt was in and women were wearing, you know, hip hugger pants. And there were a lot of women who were trying to rock them who maybe weren't actually rocking them.
Mm-hmm.
That went away. It not only did it go away, but
quickly,
it went away. And what replaced it was the whole... this trend where the athleisure, the leggings, the yoga pants, where you wear pants that come up pretty high on your waist and you wear a tunic over it, you wear a big shirt over it, that came back. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot easier for most women to rock. So, and it's a lot more comfortable too. But you can't get enough now of stretchy pants. It used to be like in the 60s, if you wore polyester pants and everybody... you know, went down, they dissed people for wearing polyester pants. Now that it's, you don't do that anymore. People wear, like I said, they wear athleisure. What am I wearing right now? I'm wearing a pair of sweats. So,
comfortable clothes.
Anyway, so it's about being comfortable, but it's also about belly bloat. Women just got sick of wearing jeans that pressed on their bellies. And so, and I can totally relate to that. And the thing is, it doesn't even matter if you're a heavy woman or not. It's your size does not matter. You're affected by the fluctuations of hormones. And so different times of the month, your belly is different sizes. Also, depending on your stress, your belly is different sizes. And depending on what you ate, your belly is different sizes. It goes up and down and up and down. And some of it is digestive, and some of it is hormonal, that the tissues in your digestive system and your omentum, the lining and covering of your abdomen and your fat tissue, just swells, because estrogen tends to draw water to it. It tends to make you swell. So if you're, again, we talked about being estrogen dominant. Estrogen dominance is something that happens to women, and it's a lot, like I said, it's a lot easier to be estrogen dominant than to be balanced in estrogen and progesterone, because progesterone, which is the hormone that comes at the second half of the month, that's the hormone that maintains the uterine lining and maintains pregnancy. Progesterone has an easy two-step pass to be turned into cortisol, which runs your fight or flight. And if your body thinks you're under stress, you're going to be making cortisol, and you're going to be taking your progesterone and making it into cortisol. Voila, you are now estrogen dominant. Once you're estrogen dominant, you're going to start swelling. And where do you swell? Well, certainly in your belly. You can swell in your breasts. I know this morning I woke up and my hands were kind of puffy. And, you know, my hormones are going to tend to go up and down. And as a menopausal woman, sometimes it's hard to tell what's going on. I did have some sweets last night. I don't know how much that makes a difference. I am definitely under stress. My swelling definitely goes down after I exercise and after I sweat. This is another thing that I read, and that's when you're in menopause, you don't make as much bile. So bile is a super important substance. You make bile in your liver. It's a substance that emulsifies fats, and it solubilizes all of the toxins that you're going to be excreting, and it emulsifies your hormones to carry them out. Your hormones get marked for excretion, and then emulsifies and then dissolves your hormones, sends them into your colon, so that you excrete them through your stool. And so you don't make as much bile. So if you don't have as much bile, you're not going to have as much substance to carry your hormones out. So again, as I said, menopausal women, we still make estrogen. We make more estrogen than progesterone. So we are still going to make estrogen from our fat tissue. We're going to be making them from our adrenal hormones. And so we're going to tend to be more estrogen dominant because we don't make as much progesterone. Progesterone is mostly made from ovulating. You ovulate, you have one part of the follicle turns into the egg, potential future baby, and the other half turns into a corpus luteum, which sits back at the ovary, makes progesterone for you to foster the pregnancy. And we don't ovulate anymore, so we don't make as much progesterone. And progesterone, when you're in menopause, it's the first hormone to tank. It's the first hormone to tank if you're cycling, because if you're stressed out, you're going to take your progesterone and turn it into cortisol. So you're going to bloat. And the bloat is going to be from lower bile. The bloat is from your food is not moving through your colon as fast as it might otherwise. And it also comes from actual swelling of the tissues. And so how do you not have this? Well, there's stuff you can do. One of the things you do is you do things to mitigate estrogen dominance. That's basically the bottom line. You mitigate estrogen dominance. So how do you do that? Well, one thing, you're going to be more estrogen dominant if you eat a lot of sugary foods and a lot of starchy foods. Why? Because you slow down the functioning of your liver. You'll also be estrogen dominant if you do too much alcohol. How much alcohol is too much? Well, one answer is it depends on the person. The other answer is no more than every other day. If you're a woman and you want to prevent breast cancer, and one of the reasons that too much alcohol can increase your risk of breast cancer is estrogen dominance, no more than 4 drinks a week. If you want to enhance your physical performance, your athletic performance, no more than 3 drinks a week, because then more than 3 drinks a week, your liver's going to be too taxed and depleted from dealing with the hormones. Okay, so anything that taxes your liver, whether it's stress, alcohol, sugar, processed foods, all of those things are going to make you more estrogen dominant. So the opposite of that, resting more, having peace, being less stressed, not drinking or drinking less, drinking lots of water, and not eating sugar and eating more healthy foods is going to make you less bloated. Caffeine can make you bloated. It depends on the person. Some people it helps them, some people it does not. Some people will get more swollen from caffeine. If you are a slow metabolizer of caffeine, you're going to be more likely to get swollen from it. And that's just because your liver is taken up with processing the caffeine and it's not as available to process other things. And that's the same with sugar, and it's the same with alcohol. Your body looks at sugar, it looks at alcohol. The more you give your liver to do, the less it's going to be able to do other stuff. And if you're interested in lowering your estrogen dominance, the less busy your liver is, the more available it is to detoxify out your extra estrogen, the less bloated you're going to be. So all the fun things, sugar, alcohol, caffeine, can all increase your bloating, and processed food, junk food, salt as well. So salt, it depends on the person. Some people process salt better than others. Some people find that if they eat a lot of salt, they'll bloat. And some people, I wonder if it's really the salt that's doing it, because when you eat something salty, that's very salty, you may be eating a lot of starch with it. So, I bloated, I ate pizza. It must be the salt. Yeah, maybe it was the dairy, and maybe it was the huge...
I was going to say, there's a whole lot more going on pizza than it's just salt. Salt's
right.
Like the minor issue compared to everything else.
Well, it could be dairy, and it could be all the starch.
Right.
Absolutely. And you're eating a lot of all of that stuff.
Right. Or it could be the fact that gluten makes you a little bloaty, and, you know, a lot of people, even if they're not, quote-unquote, allergic to it,
yes,
but they're still going to bloat out, right?
Well, whether you eat gluten or not, every good weightlifter who's preparing for a show knows that carbs make you bloat. Carbs,
oh, absolutely.
Carbs draw water to them. It doesn't matter if they have gluten in them or not.
Yep.
People right before a weightlifting show, they carb starve themselves. I mean,
yeah,
they eat protein and vegetables, and that's it. Say what you will about low-carb diets, and, you know, people are like, oh, low-carb diets are not sustainable and all that. But people who are really interested in getting the bloat down, outgo the carbs. That's it.
Same with wrestlers and boxers.
If they're trying to make weight.
Yeah.
Which is crazy, because you need those carbs to fuel your workout.
Oh,
and
I know.
Yet if you're trying to make weight, you're looking at protein and non-starchy vegetables, and that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you want to really quick de-bloatify yourself, you can go on a diet of protein and non-starchy vegetables and drink lots of water. And do a couple of days of that, and you won't be bloated, and you'll get rid of a lot of extra fluid. And you'll spend a lot of time in the bathroom. So,
we had a caller, and we have to address this really quickly,
because
this is one of those rare phone calls that you don't normally get on Radio Naturopath, and I'm mildly amused by it, but I am also, of course, one of these people. We got a call from Lisa in Stafford Springs, who's listening to the show, and she's a small person. She's very healthy. She weighs 100 pounds. She can't gain weight. And I said, Lisa, why do you want to gain weight? She said, all my friends are big, and I don't fit in around them because of that. So she's concerned at how she looks next to all of her friends.
My brain hurts.
I know. I thought you'd enjoy this. So anyway, I reassured Lisa that she's fine. She's doing the right thing. She probably has a high metabolism. That's, you know, and if you can't gain weight, then your body doesn't want to gain weight. It's okay. It's very
happy.
As
long as she's healthy.
She says she's completely healthy.
If she has a health condition that's making her not gain weight and it's hurting her, like she doesn't have good energy, she can't, there's certain things she can't do in her life because she's underweight. It's not the underweight that's doing it. It's the condition.
Right.
But if she has no health conditions and that's her size,
it's great. I told
her
about my sister and my mother. I mean, I come from a family of small people.
Yeah.
And small people are okay.
As
long as they're healthy. But there are a lot more large people in our world right now. So
right.
It makes her actually feel uncomfortable. Isn't that interesting?
It is interesting. Yeah. And this is about body love. Love your body. Love yourself the way you are.
Yeah.
Yep.
I say good for you, Lisa.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
That's fine.
Just a little thing I had to throw in there.
Yeah. So, belly bloat, that it's an interesting thing. And it is, And like I said, the quickest way to not be bloated is protein and vegetables. Barring that, just watching all of the things that can make you more likely to be less bloated. And also progesterone can make you bloat a little bit too. But again, estrogen and progesterone have to be in balance. And if they're in balance, you're going to be less likely to be bloated. So there's certain things you can eat, mostly produce. Your non-starchy vegetables, eating your salads, eating your stir fries, watching it with the salt, and watching it with the sugar and carbs. That's basically what you do. So anyway, let's see. We're gonna be wrapping it up in a little bit. One of the things I had wanted to talk about is some of the harmful effects of caffeine, but there's a lot of them, so I think I'm going to have to wait for next week for that. I did want to remind you again that I will be at the Mansfield Community Center tonight at 6:30 p.m. giving a talk about asthma and allergies, and you're welcome to come to that if you wish, and you can call the Mansfield Community Center at 860-429-3015 for more information about that. And if you're suffering from asthma and allergies, it makes sense because there's a lot of pollen in the air right now. If you go to pollen.com, we've got a pretty high level of pollen, and that seems weird because you don't see any leaves on the trees, but my goodness, the buds on the trees are definitely popping out pollen. The trees are talking to each other and trying to pollinate each other. So there's definitely a lot going on there. So good time to break out the old neti pot, good time to break out the old nettle tea, whatever works for you, for your allergies, your local honey, all that kind of stuff. If you want to hear more about that, we can talk about that more tonight. So that's very exciting.
Trees talk to one another?
They did chemically. We don't know. What do they talk about? So how's your leaves?
Yeah.
I don't know. They're not ready to come out yet. What about you? Yeah, mine are about to pop. I think I'm going to go tomorrow. Really?
Right. Yeah. Hey, is your sap flowing?
My sap's flowing. It's pretty good.
You got a nice layer of bark on you.
Yeah, these strange people keep coming, and they put these blue tubes, they stick these metal things into me.
They're draining me.
Yeah. But
that's over.
I mean, it's kind of unpleasant, but it doesn't bother me too much, and I just make more sap. So.
Yeah.
But they seem to enjoy doing it. I wonder what they're doing with it. Yeah.
What trees talk about?
I'm gonna go for a bike ride today. I've been riding my bike a lot.
You are.
Yeah,
you have been riding your bike a lot. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, but I'm not going to ride my bike on probably not going to ride on Friday or Saturday. I'm very sad about not riding Saturday, but I'm sort of happy that I will be going to the Connecticut Naturopathic Physicians Association conference.
You're going to get smart.
I'm going to get smart. It's at Wesleyan University this year. That's why I get to go to Middletown.
You're already pretty smart.
All right. Yeah. I'm going to get smarter.
Yeah, okay.
I'm going to see my naturopathic colleagues who will say nice things to me, and I'll see my my vendor colleagues as well. That's kind of fun. And I'll get more information, so I might have some cool new information for you next week after being smartened up by the conference.
Well, isn't that great?
I know, right?
It's a beautiful thing.
But the only sad thing is that it's going to be the nicer of the 2 days, that on Sunday we're going to have to ride through the raindrops.
Oh, yeah, I heard that. Yeah, that we might get a little rain.
It's not going to be a great day. Yeah, but we need the rain. So.
Yeah, you know, we'll live.
All right. So you know that you're listening to 91.7 FM, WHUS Storrs. I am Fran Storrs. For the last hour, you were listening to Radio Naturopath. We hope you'll listen to us next week, and we hope you'll listen to us on podcast at WHUS.org and also on iTunes. And we'll be back next week with more Radio Naturopath here on WHUS 91.7 FM.